My family sometimes accuse me of being somebody who can never say no. They're probably right. I certainly do have a tendency to overcommit myself, and I'm quite prepared to admit it is a weakness. This morning, however, I want to suggest to you, perhaps at least partly in my own defence, that there is a greater and more dangerous fault than the inability to say no. And that's the inability to say yes. In his book, The Great Divorce, C.S. Lewis provides a fascinating allegory designed to illustrate precisely this point. He imagines a whole busload of ghosts being given the chance, having spent their time in hell, to visit at least the borders of heaven. As tourists, you might say. They're told on arrival that if they want to, they can make the journey through heaven to the mountains of God and thus become permanent residents of heaven. But as the story proceeds, one by one, each of them refuses and opts instead to take the bus back to hell. Their reasons are various. One pompous, self-righteous ghost says no because he's outraged to find an acquaintance of his in heaven who had committed murder. I may be a poor man, he says, but I'm not making pals with him. Tell them I'm not coming, see? I'd rather be damned than go along with him. Tell you what, damned, I mean. Another ghost says no because he's a cynic. He's convinced the whole invitation to heaven is a cunning con trick designed by them, whoever they may be. Another says no because he's an artist. He's more interested in painting the mountains of God than undertaking the difficult journey to get there. Still another is a grumbler, locked so inescapably in its self-generated whirlpool of self-pity that negative responses seem to be the only sort of response it's capable of. Then there's a nagging wife, indignant because God will not let her go on henpecking her husband in heaven. And there's a possessive mother, who's furious with rage because the son she idolized has not been sent to meet her. Perhaps most comic of all, there is a bishop. A bishop so wedded to his liberal theology, he can't bear the thought of truth being something final and absolute. Lewis provides an absolutely brilliant portrayal of this man in conversation with one of the residents of heaven called Dick. "Will you come with me to the mountains?" asks Dick. "Will you come?" "Well," replies the bishop, "I'm perfectly ready to consider it, though of course I should require some assurances. I should want a guarantee that you're taking me to a place where I shall find an atmosphere of free inquiry." "No," replies Dick, "I can't promise you that. I will bring you to a land not of questions, but of answers. You will see the face of God." "Ah, God," says the bishop. "But we must all interpret that beautiful word in our own way, mustn't we? For me, there is no such thing as a final answer. The free wind of inquiry must always continue to blow through the mind, must it not? You must surely feel yourself, Dick, that there is something stifling about the idea of finality. Stagnation, my dear boy, what could be more soul-destroying than stagnation? Which reminds me, bless my soul, I'd nearly forgotten. Of course I can't come with you. I have to be back next Friday to read a paper. We have a little theological society down there, you know. I'm taking that text about growing up to the measure of the stature of Christ. I'm going to point out how people always forget that Jesus was a comparatively young man when he died. He would have outgrown some of his earlier views, you know, if he'd lived. I'm going to ask my audience to consider what his maturer opinions might have been. A profoundly interesting question. What a different Christianity we might have if only the founder had reached his full stature. I shall finish by pointing out how this deepens the significance of the crucifixion. One feels for the first time what a disaster it was, what a tragic waste. So much promise cut short. Oh, must you be going, Dick? Well, so must I. It's been so stimulating talking to you again. Goodbye. Lewis tells us, the ghost smiled a bright clerical smile and made his way back to the bus, humming softly to itself. City of God, how broad, how far. So the tragic succession of refusals goes on. With punishing irony, C.S. Lewis shows us in that book that people are not sent to hell. They go there of their own free choice. Even when faced with the opportunity of heaven, they turn their back on it. It's the most provocative and challenging book. If you've not read it, I do recommend it to you. And this morning, in our Bible study, the evangelist Mark is seeking, I think, to make essentially the same point. In a way not unlike the way Lewis makes it. As we've noticed in previous week, Mark likes to draw together snippets from Jesus' life which share the same theme. In chapter 4, we found three parables, all built around the idea of the growing seed. In chapter 5, we saw four miracles, each of which was called forth by a rather similar experience of human helplessness and desperation. Well, now this week, in chapter 6, once again, we find a number of superficially unrelated incidents, which on closer examination are found to have a common link. Each illustrates the way in which people said no to Jesus. Let me point them out to you. The first is the rejection of Jesus himself by his own fellow countrymen, verses 1 to 6. Jesus went to his hometown, we read, accompanied by his disciples. And when the Sabbath came, he began to teach in the synagogue, and many who heard him were amazed. Where did this man get these things, they asked? What's this wisdom that has been given him, that he even does miracles? Isn't this the carpenter? Isn't this Mary's son? And they took offense. I suppose when somebody you've grown up with begins to show clear evidence that they're going to outshine you, it always does put a strain on your relationship with them, doesn't it? The sibling who fails his O-levels feels resentful at having to live in the shadow of that older brother who's doing so well at university. The plain Jane who's never had a boyfriend feels jealous of that girl next door she used to play with, that has now turned into such a beauty with a constant stream of hopeful young men at her heels. It's inevitable, I suppose. In fact, faced with outstanding merit or success or popularity in another person, we inevitably feel our egos threatened. It takes a very big heart, doesn't it? Not to pick holes, to sling mud, as a kind of defense against our own feelings of wounded self-esteem. And at Nazareth, it seems, Jesus' old neighbors just didn't have hearts of sufficient capacity. His preaching at their synagogue had clearly been outstanding, and his reputation for working miracles had gone ahead of him too. Those who'd known him from a child were understandably astonished. They hadn't realized they had such a talent living in their midst. But rather than accept the humble dignity of admiring and congratulating that which so clearly surpassed them, we find them instead sniping peevishly at this new celebrity status he had found. Surprised they may have been, but they refused to be impressed. Instead, their gasps of wonder turn into sneers of cynicism. Who's he to go around preaching and healing, they say. He's never been to theological college. He's not a proper rabbi. He's just a craftsman, that's all. We've known his family for years. They're nothing special. Talking of his family, do you notice that Mary is the only parent mentioned in verse 3? Almost certainly that's intended as a further slur on Jesus' character. It would be normal, you see, in Jewish practice to identify a man as the son of his father, Jesus bar Joseph. That would have been his normal surname. The fact that no reference is made to Jesus, his father, strongly suggests that the residents of Nazareth regarded him as illegitimate. A charge hinted at on other occasions in the Gospels, too. No, they said, he's just a working-class Galilean, born the wrong side of the blankets. That's all he is. If you ask me, he's got ideas above his station. Carpentry's not good enough for the likes of him, I suppose. No, he's got to be a star. With his drooling little fan club following around. If only they knew what we know about him. Son of God, what a laugh. Son of Mary, you mean. Nudge, nudge, wink, wink. So, says Mark, they took offense at him. And that's become the first of these three examples he wants to show us of people whose problem was they couldn't say yes. The second example begins in verse 7. The rejection this time, not of Jesus personally, but of Jesus' disciples. Jesus went around teaching from village to village, and calling the 12 to him, he sent them out two by two and gave them authority over evil spirits. These were his instructions: take nothing for the journey except a staff, no bread, no bag, no money in your belts, wear sandals but not an extra tunic. Whenever you enter a house, stay there until you leave that town. And if any place will not welcome you or listen to you, shake the dust off your feet when you leave, as a testimony against them. Down through the years, people have seen different things in these verses. Francis of Assisi, of course, saw a model here for all Christian ministry. The evangelist, he said, should be an itinerant beggar wandering from place to place. He even tried to literally emulate the clothing Jesus specifies here, down to the staff and the sandals, as Franciscan friars do even today. It's certain, I think, that that is to misunderstand the purpose of the passage, no matter how laudable Francis's aspirations may have been. The later missionary journeys of St. Paul, for instance, don't follow this rigid pattern. In fact, seen against the background of the rest of the New Testament, I think it's clear that Jesus' instructions here to the 12 were limited to this one excursion, at least as far as the details are concerned. Most commentators recognize that, that this is a one-off expedition, and so treat it as a kind of training exercise. Jesus is preparing his disciples for the rigors of their later apostolic ministry, so he gives them an evangelistic project to accomplish that forces them to cope with hardship and to live by faith. I think undoubtedly there is an element of truth in that. There's no question that being a disciple of Jesus involved practical as well as theoretical equipping for service. It may be that a group like Operation Mobilization provides rather similar training experience for young Christians today, as Jesus was providing for his own disciples. But the aspect of this mission of theirs, which it seems to me many overlook, is the stress Jesus places here in the final advice he gives on the possibility of rejection. If any place you come to will not welcome you or listen to you, shake the dust off your feet when you leave, as a testimony against them. Fact is, you see, by denying his disciples spare cash or clothes or food, Jesus was placing an onus of responsibility on the villages to which they went, an onus of responsibility to be hospitable to them. As destitute men without shelter, they couldn't be ignored. Every village they entered had to make a decision, either to welcome them and care for them, or to reject them. And Jesus knew, of course, from his own recent experience in Nazareth, that as disciples of his, the latter would be a common occurrence. They would encounter whole towns, like Nazareth, that would close their doors. Even the casting out of unclean spirits would not guarantee a favorable reception, as his own healing, you remember, of that violent lunatic back in chapter 5 had demonstrated. In fact, if you look up the parallel passage to this in Matthew chapter 10, you will find this anticipation of hostility on Jesus' part is developed into a much longer excursus on the persecutions which Christians must expect. When you take the gospel out to the world, Jesus goes on to say to them, you'll be handed over to synagogues and flogged. You'll be brought before governments and kings on trial. Your own family will betray you. Everybody will hate you, he says. But remember this. Anybody who receives you receives me. And as for those cities who reject you, why, it will be more tolerable for Sodom and Gomorrah, he said, on the day of judgment, than for those towns. So Jesus is certainly preparing his disciples for ministry here, but in particular, he's preparing them to meet resistance. Again and again, he says, you will face the heartache of meeting people who refuse to respond. Preach, heal all you like. They will not repent. They will not say yes. And as if to illustrate the point, Mark gives us a third example. The rejection not of Jesus or of his disciples this time. The rejection of Jesus' herald, John the Baptist. King Herod heard about all this, for Jesus' name had become well known. Some were saying, John the Baptist has been raised from the dead, and that's why miraculous powers at work in him. Others said, he's Elijah, and still others claimed, he's a prophet like one of the prophets of old. But when Herod heard it, he said, John, the man I beheaded, has been raised from the dead. And without more ado, Mark launches into a kind of flashback to tell us how Herod did just that. Execute the last of the prophets, John the Baptist. It's a fascinating story. It provides, among other things, a moving insight of the truly prophetic character of John's ministry, doesn't it? Living as he did in the shadow of Jesus, we perhaps forget what an outstanding man he was. John said to Herod, it is not lawful for you to have your brother's wife. That kind of courageous denunciation of moral corruption in high places is strongly reminiscent of the finest of the Old Testament prophets. In fact, this whole story bears an uncanny similarity to Elijah's encounter with King Ahab, with Herodias, of course, playing the role of that formidable Jezebel. Just like Ahab, Herod is revealed here to be a pathetically weak man, isn't he? Totally dominated by his ruthless and vindictive wife. In his heart, we're told, he was intrigued by John, even a little terrified by him, verse 20. He feared John and protected him, knowing him to be a righteous and holy man. When he heard him, he was puzzled, but he liked to listen to him. But Herod's conscience was no match for the viciousness of Herodias' malice. She takes her opportunity. What shall I ask for? Salome asks her mother. The head of John the Baptist, she replies. There are unanswered questions, of course. Was it a plot or just opportunism on Herodias' part? Was this the famous dance of the seven veils Salome performed, or something less sensuous? Novelists and Hollywood have not been slow to weave their imaginations around the words of Mark and tell us what really happened. But one thing is clear, isn't it? Herod's only reason for not revoking his rash oath and denying Herodias her pound of flesh was his own pride. He was greatly distressed, but because of his oaths and his dinner guests, he did not want to refuse her. Just see it, can't you? How can I, the king, having made this extravagant gesture, possibly go back on my word? It would be humiliating. All my court would laugh at me. No, I must give her what she wants or lose face. And one gets the distinct impression that weak, pathetic Herod's face was immensely precious to him. A tragic story, isn't it? the judicial murder of a good man for no crime but telling the truth. It makes interesting reading. But the question is, why does Mark include it? He's supposed to be telling the story of Jesus. Isn't it a little odd that he should suddenly insist on flashing back this incident in the life of the Baptist? Well, the answer to that riddle, I think, has to be found in this theme that we've observed. Mark sees John's martyrdom as one more example in his catalogue of refusals. Here is somebody else saying no, not to Jesus personally this time, nor to his disciples, but to his prophetic herald. This is just one more example of the kind of rejection which the good news of the kingdom receives. I'm sure we're not speculating wildly in that regard, for Jesus makes the remark later on in the Gospel of Mark, which shows quite clearly he saw the execution of John as significant in this regard. In chapter 9, verse 11 to 13. Elijah has come, he says, and they have done to him everything they wished, just as it's written about him. Jesus saw the death of John the Baptist almost as a premonition of his own passion. The courts of justice that were too weak and corrupt to defend God's prophet will prove equally incapable of defending me, God's Messiah, he says. I too will be despised and rejected by men, just as John the Baptist was. So three opportunities and three refusals. That's what Mark presents us with today. Clearly, like C.S. Lewis, Mark believes the biggest mistakes are made not by those who cannot say no, but by those who will not say yes. And so quietly, implicitly almost, he invites us by these three examples of refusal to make sure our response is not a negative one. Let's just note the lessons that there are to be learned arising out of these three stories. The first is this. Some people say no to Jesus because their minds are prejudiced against him from the start. Notice Jesus' comment back in verse 4 about his fellow countrymen. Jesus said to them, "Only in his hometown, among his relatives, and in his own house is a prophet without honor." We have a saying, don't we? Familiarity breeds contempt. Jesus tells us here, when it comes to recognizing the authority of God in somebody's life, familiarity breeds not just contempt, but blindness. The person least likely to recognize a prophet, he says, is the person who lives next door to him. If only Jesus had been more exotic, then maybe the residents of Nazareth may have been less hostile to him. But because they knew him so well, they couldn't see what was glaring and obvious to unprejudiced eyes. I think something rather similar to that happens to people who've grown up in an atmosphere of Christian culture and civilization, or within a Christian family, perhaps. They're prejudiced by it. I often tell the new students up at the university here the story G.K. Chesterton recounts of the White Horse. Maybe some of you remember it. I'm sure I've told it before. It's a story of how a young man who lives in Wessex hears tell of a white horse that's been carved into the hillside somewhere, but he doesn't know where it is. So he goes off searching for it and travels the whole world over. But he can't find the white horse he dreams of. Finally, at the end of a very long journey, he comes back from a distant land, demoralized, disappointed, and sees his own hometown in the distance. And lo and behold, there is the white horse he'd been looking for. And his own village was in the middle of it. He'd been living amongst it all that time, but he'd never been able to see it because of the familiarity of his environment. It's a parable, of course. Chesterton is showing us how people sometimes need to take an intellectual and an emotional journey out of the Christian environment in which they have been brought up, if they are really to break out of their natural prejudice against that Christian background and have an objective appreciation of their religious heritage. I remember one young man I talked to once who had, in the romance of youth, gone on the journey through Afghanistan, the drug trail to the east, you know, visited many places, read many philosophies, tried many experiences. Yet he hadn't found what he was looking for. Then, strange to say, when he came back to the Christian heritage he had left and saw it new, he suddenly realized what he'd been looking for had been there all along. As close as the Bible on the bookshelf and the old chapel on the street corner. But like the boy in search of the white horse, he'd never seen it before because it was hidden in the very familiarity of these things. Maybe some of us here are victim to a similar prejudice. A Sunday school hang-up. Maybe we need to conduct that same imaginative experiment, to approach Jesus as some of his contemporaries who didn't know him did, as a mysterious stranger, somebody novel, exotic. Maybe if we can succeed in that imaginative experiment, we may realize just how remarkable Jesus is. But do beware of, like the residents of Nazareth, saying no to him just because he's too tied up with your own family background and cultural environment. You'll be the loser if you do. That brings me to the second lesson we can find in these three incidents. If we say no, Jesus is not going to work a miracle to force us to change our minds. Look at verses 5 and 6. He could not do any miracles there except lay his hands on a few sick people and heal them. We have a saying, don't we? Seeing is believing. Well, clearly Jesus didn't think it was. One might have expected that his response to such rank skepticism regarding his messianic claims would have been to blow the minds of his fellow countrymen with a few exhibitions of supernatural power. But that wasn't Jesus' policy. Indeed, ironically enough, it was not this time the crowds who are left at the end of the day speechless with wonder, but Jesus himself. He was amazed at their lack of faith. Clearly, then, miracles were not regarded by Jesus as a solution to the problem of unbelief. On the contrary, faith was the prerequisite for there to be any point at all in working miracles, as far as he was concerned. See how Mark puts it in verse 5? Not only would he not work many miracles there, he could not. It's a startling choice of verb, isn't it? Does Mark imply that Jesus was rendered powerless by the unbelief of his fellow countrymen? Surely not. God can do what he likes when he likes, can't he? His freedom to act isn't controlled by us. To suggest otherwise is to turn faith into a kind of magic ingredient which God needs to work his magic spells. Now, Jesus' inability to do miracles in Nazareth simply evidences that he had no mandate from God his Father to be a mere wonder worker. Jesus' miracles were designed not to awaken faith, but to confirm it. Not to convince the doubter, but to reassure the believer. That's why whenever we see Jesus working miracles in the Gospels, you will always find a germ of faith is there before the miracle takes place. This has important consequences on a number of fronts. There are those, some of you will know, who insist in the church today that there must be signs and wonders in order to persuade people to become Christians. We can't expect people to believe just because we preach Jesus, they say. They must see miracles too, as they did in the New Testament. Well, frankly, I'm not in the least impressed by that line of argument. I don't deny that miracles happen. And I don't deny that we in the Western Church have perhaps tended to have unnecessarily low expectations when it comes to supernatural healings and such like. But to suggest that people need to witness such things in order to become believers is totally inconsistent with what we find Jesus here doing in Mark 6, isn't it? as far as the New Testament is concerned, seeing isn't believing. On the contrary, faith, says the Apostle Paul, comes by hearing. To walk by faith, he says, is the very opposite of walking by sight. So if your reason for saying no to Jesus is that God hasn't shown you a miracle yet, I've got news for you. It's most unlikely he ever will. And even if he did, I don't believe it would make any difference. Jesus says to you the same thing he said to doubting Thomas. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet believe. Say no to him and he's not going to work a miracle to prove you wrong. He's quite prepared to accept your refusal, just as he accepted the refusal of his fellow countrymen. What's more, he tells me that I must be prepared to accept your refusal too. And that brings me to the third lesson it's worth learning from these three little incidents. If we say no to Jesus, the day may come when he will say no to us. But verse 11. If any place will not welcome you or listen to you, shake the dust off your feet when you leave as a testimony against them. It's always hard when people like me are faced with hostility, people who don't accept our testimony. And one mistake it's very easy to make in our desperate desire to make people change their attitude is to compromise. We can compromise the message for a start, change it into something more acceptable to our hearers. The Muslim finds the divinity of Jesus offensive. Well, we'll cut that bit out then. The Hindu finds the exclusiveness of Jesus offensive. Well, we'll cut that bit out then. The humanist finds hell offensive. Well, we'll cut that bit out then. So it goes on. Plenty of so-called theology today is characterized by just that kind of policy of a tactical surrender. Alternatively, if we don't compromise our message, we may compromise our methods. Try to circumvent the hardened attitude we're encountering in some other way. Emotionalism, for instance, if we can't obtain a profession of faith through a rational commitment of the will, then we can try to exploit people's feelings. Or we can offer psychological bribes to faith. We can promise children to the barren, examination passes to the student, jobs to the unemployed, rice to the hungry, visas to the refugee. If Jesus had been with us today, his disciples might well have been tempted to use some of our new sophisticated techniques of human manipulation, mightn't they? The hidden persuaders of our modern world, the subliminal advertisers, the behavioral conditioners, the brainwashers. People have been converted from one detergent to another by those sort of methods. They've been converted from Omo to Persil. Why not from communist to Christian? Well, we Christians know we're right. We'd only be doing it for their own good, wouldn't we? Well, suffice it to say, Jesus will not allow his disciples to compromise either their message or their method. Self-determination is part of human dignity, you see. God made man a creature who knew freedom and responsibility. And respect for that dignity requires that Christians shall never join the ranks of those officious dictators of mass opinion who seek to control the world by manipulations of one kind or another. Like Paul wrote to the Corinthians, we have renounced disgraceful, underhanded methods and we refuse to practice cunning or to tamper with God's word. The disciples of Jesus could only use those strategies of persuasion that were consistent with the biblical understanding of human dignity. And the awful consequence of that commitment, says Jesus, is that sometimes you will have to allow people to damn themselves. Hell is a dreadful place. But hell gives more dignity to a human being than a brainwasher does. For hell respects a man's choice. Hell accepts the sinner's refusal. Hell treats us as responsible human beings. Your blood be on your own head, it says to us. Our 20th century brainwasher will not give us the dignity of being punished for our crimes. Instead, it seeks to reprogram us as if we were some malleable lump of clay to be molded at will by those who know what's good for us. You know, hell may be a dreadful thought, but the men who suffer there are still men. God may be a sovereign, but he is no tyrant. They wanted independence of him. They've got it. They said no to Jesus. The day came when he said no to them. Be warned then. Ultimately, you see, it is not we who judge him, but he who judges us. Say no to him too often, and we may find at the end of the day, he says no to you. But that brings us to the fourth and final lesson I'd like you to think about this morning, flowing out of these three examples of refusal. Jesus does not easily go away. Just look at verses 14 to 16 again. King Herod heard all about it. Some were saying Jesus was Elijah, still others that he was a prophet like one of the prophets of long ago. But when Herod heard it, he said, no. John, the man I beheaded, has been raised from the dead. There's something a little bit comical about Herod here, isn't there? Like Macbeth, haunted by Banquo's ghost, so Herod is haunted by the guilt of his murderous past. It's John the Baptist, reincarnate, he says, clothed in supernatural power now from the other side of the grave. This time he doesn't just preach terrifying sermons, he works terrifying miracles too. But as pathetic as Herod's superstitious fears may have been, they also indicate, don't they, that the opportunity for change in this man had not finally passed him by. In his weakness and his pride, he had surrendered to the pressure of others and said no to God, even executing God's prophet. But that niggling awareness of spiritual things that had made him listen to John in the first place, it still tormented him. He's a bit like one of those ghosts from hell that C.S. Lewis talks about. He's being given a second chance, isn't he? The dust of Herod's rejection has not been finally shaken from Jesus' shoes yet. Jesus hadn't gone away. Herod could still say yes if he wanted. So can you. So can you this morning. You may have said no to Jesus on many, many occasions in the past. Indeed, it may be that familiarity with Jesus has bred contempt in you of this whole Christianity show. If you think he's going to work a miracle to force you to change your mind, you're mistaken. He is quite prepared to accept your refusal. But he hasn't yet abandoned you. Any more than he had abandoned Herod, Jesus doesn't go away that easily. The opportunity to revise your response is available to you this morning. Indeed, it may be that, like Herod, there are some here this morning who find God's persistent voice haunting their consciences, no matter what steps they take to silence it. The choice is ours. The mountains of God, or the bus to hell. It's as simple as yes or no? Let's pray together. A few moments of quiet, and then I'm going to read a prayer and meditation by Michel Quast. It's entitled, Help Me to Say Yes. I am afraid of saying yes, Lord. Where will you take me? I am afraid of drawing the longer straw. I am afraid of signing my name to an unread agreement. I am afraid of the yes that entails other yeses. And yet I'm not at peace. You pursue me, Lord. You besiege me. I run after noise for fear of hearing you, but in a moment of silence, you slip through. I turn from the road, for I have caught sight of you, but at the end of the path, you are there, waiting for me. Where shall I hide? I meet you everywhere. Is it then impossible to escape you? But I am afraid to say yes, Lord. I am afraid of putting my hand in yours, for you hold on to it. I am afraid of meeting your eyes, for you can win me. I am afraid of your demands, but, O Lord, who can resist you? That your kingdom may come, and not mine, that your will may be done, and not mine, help me to say yes.